This podcast is brought to you by Podomatic, one of the internet's leading podcast hosting providers. Podomatic will give you all the publication tools you need to make your podcast simple, easy, and fun. To start your free account today, just visit podomatic.com. You can also upgrade to a pro account for as little as $9.99 per month. So make your podcasting experience worthwhile and make it with Podomatic. Well, once again, you're listening to the Potter Pensive Podcast, episode 51. Heather and myself, Adam, are in the studio today, and I just wanted to start this episode off by wishing the Potter Pensive Podcast a very happy fourth birthday.
Oh, wow. It can start, like, kindergarten pretty soon.
Yeah, that's right. It's almost ready to go into public school. So, 4 years ago, on this very day... Oh, Happy New Year to all the listeners.
Oh, yeah, right, that one.
And to you, Heather, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Adam.
Yeah, thank you. I hope you had a really great Christmas.
Or Hanukkah.
On this, yeah, and then, but on this day, 4 years ago, we recorded our very first episode. So, we're going to continue looking at Harry, or we're going to continue our analysis of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and I think we're finishing up, like book-wise, we're finishing up movie one. We have a very limited number of episodes left.
Yep.
Which is kind of shocking because I never thought we would actually get there. But So, let's look at some listener feedback. Oh, first of all, before we do, I just want to apologize to all the listeners. Sometimes when we record, and I know we've said this before, you know, sometimes when we're not really thinking, our mouths tend to run off on us and we say one or two swear words. So I apologize if people are offended, and just by accident, as I was editing last week, I accidentally skipped over a lovely swear word that Ms. Heather said last week. So we received...
So technically it's Adam's fault.
Technically it's my fault. Okay, Yes it is, since I was in charge, yes. I apologize. But yeah, that happens sometimes, and it was funny because... I went on the email about a couple weeks later after the episode had been released, and we got a few emails from people who were like, you know, I just thought you should know, Heather swore at this point, or at this time in the podcast, and it was really funny because one of the people, she just put, Heather needs some Orbit White to clean that dirty mouth.
Well, guys, you hear this? That's the sound of a tin of mints next to me now, just in case.
So yeah, apologies for that, guys. That happens sometimes. Anyways, let's get into some Facebook feedback. A couple months ago, I put up the question of the week. And the question was, give us your take on house elf slavery. Are house elves superior to humans because of the types of magic they can produce? How do you think they came to be positioned as slaves? And then I put in brackets, we discussed this in the latest episode with regards to creature. So Lizzie Fleck, she replies with a bit of a lengthy reply. She says, I think house elves are equal with wizards. They possess great magic like wizards, and they have a lot of potential with that magic like wizards. Ron constantly argued that house elves liked working without being paid, and the fact of the matter is that they do. Yes, it is at the fault of wizards, because that is all house elves know. I like how Dumbledore handled the situation with Dobby, and I think that is how all wizards should be willing to handle the situation. If they have a house elf that wants to be a free working elf, then they should allow it. But if they have a house elf that wants to be a slaved elf, then they should keep it traditional. The problem is that this would not happen. Would you rather employ someone who wants to be paid or employ someone who wants to work for just room and board?
I feel like there should be regulations involved by the ministry.
Well, yeah.
If you're going to pay in a household just in room and board, they should make sure that the room and board that you give matches the work that is done, that it's up to standard, and that it would be the equivalent of what a house elf could get with the wages given.
Yeah, I agree with that. But, you know, okay, I'm thinking of house elves in general and how... Because Ron, yeah, he argued that house elves like working without being paid, right? And
yes.
It bugs me that... And I want to know why house elves... Like, okay, they want to work for being paid, like, without being paid, but does that necessarily mean that they want to be slaves?
Well, I suppose it's just their culture. They never use money within themselves. They don't have any commerce, and they never go out and buy things and don't participate in the economy that way. So I think that they're just unfamiliar with the concept of money, because yeah. I don't know how house elves came into being. Like, I don't know if they have always been employed or enslaved by wizards, depending on how you look at it. And I yeah. wonder if I'd be interested to know if there was a time before that when house elves ran their own societies and how they were conducted. Because yeah. maybe okay. those were a non-monetary society and just relied on maybe the trade and barter system.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then it's really interesting because Aaron, another listener, replies underneath, I kind of look at house elves a lot like how housewives used to be looked at. That they just stayed at home, raised the children, took care of their husband, did all the cooking and cleaning. Many women wanted to continue to do that, where others wanted to go into the workforce and earn their own money. That may be an unfair comparison, but that's what I think. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
That sort of makes sense. Because there are many women did feel oppressed by the system of just being expected to work in the house and not have a life outside of the home. But then yeah. others choose to do that, and some choose to do both. And I think as long as you have the option available to you to do anything, then that's what really matters, is just having those options available to you that you're not forced to do one thing or the other.
Yeah, I also find it kind of sad that those who want to work without being paid, or like, you know, looking at housewives... way back in the day and comparing them to house elves, you know, because of what they wanted to do, they were frowned upon, I guess, or looked down upon, as seen as inferior, I guess, and I think that's
true. There is a lot of, in the world today, even still, there are a lot of women who are looked down upon if they choose to go into the more feminine workforces or to just stay home and work from there and raising their family. And caring for others. There's still a lot of, I can't think of the word right now.
A lot of prejudice?
A lot of prejudice against them, right, thank you. And saying that, like, their work is inferior somehow.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for replying to the question of the week. I'll probably put up a new one.
More like question of the past 2 months.
Question of the past 2 months. I'll put up another. No, the next one will be question of the week. I swear to God, it has to be question of the week or else. Yeah, never mind. But I'll post up a new one after we finish recording this episode and I'll see what you guys have to say to that. We have one more little tidbit of listener feedback. This is in response to last month's episode, episode 50, and it's Lizzie, and she says, so at about 25 minutes, Adam is talking about how it's sad that Harry had to confront his parents' death on Christmas, but I think it is so appropriate. Most people that have lost a loved one visit their loved one's gravesite at Christmas time. I love that Harry's first visit to his parents is at Christmas time. So yeah, I actually do agree with that. I mean, it is kind of upsetting that he, like, it's upsetting that he's going to visit his parents' grave anyways, like, at any time of year, you know?
Yeah.
But I will agree that if he does have to do it, the Christmas time would probably be the best time of year to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You've changed my mind, Lizzie.
Yeah, because he can't exactly go on the anniversary of their deaths, because that's Halloween.
Oh, that's right.
And, like, can you imagine going to visit your parents' graves for the first time, and you just pass all of these people dressed up in, like, strange costumes, and, like, shouting and running around on sugar highs.
Okay, so that's about it for listener feedback. So was there anything else we wanted to announce? I don't think so. Oh, I'll let everybody know where Chio is at the moment.
Where is Chio?
Chio is happily spending some vacation time in Florida. And he will be returning with us, if not next week, then the week after. And he's going to post some pictures up on the... He's going to go back to the Wizarding World, and he's going to take pictures of all the updates that they put. And so he's going to post that on the Facebook group, and I'll put them up on the website. He doesn't know that he's going to do this for me yet, but you know, I'm just saying that he will. So that's where he is now. Anyways, let's get into some chapters now.
Oh, yeah.
Chapter 20. Xenophilius Lovegood.
Okay, so this is the first chapter after Ron's heroic return, and things are a little tense between the three of them, because Hermione's sort of refusing to acknowledge Ron's presence, which is completely understandable, as he walked out on them and all that, and Harry is kind of like, hey guys, let's all get along. Yeah.
Be friends. We can do this, guys. Come on. Yeah.
But
you know what Ron should have done? Ron should have bribed Hermione with chocolate.
Yeah, that works.
That would have worked. It works all the time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, also because they're starving in the woods.
Oh, right. So they can't really bribe anyone with chocolate.
Like, why didn't Ron bring some more food with him when he came?
I have no idea.
Come on, Ron. Get your act together.
Yeah, buddy. Come on. Jeez.
No, but in all fairness, Ron does serve a very important purpose in this chapter as sort of a link to the outside world, because he's been away from the tent and the camping activities for a while.
Yeah.
We find out he was in Shell Cottage with Bill and Fleur Weasley, hanging out with them, and so he learns all these things about the Wizarding World, which I feel like that's a really good idea. The trio probably should have thought to send Ron out on like a sort of expedition.
I agree.
Like, every once in a while, just to keep them updated on what's going on.
Well, but I could also see why they wouldn't do that, because, I mean, Hermione... I could see Hermione saying, no, we can't do that, because it's too dangerous.
Well, yeah, it's dangerous, but it'd be dangerous beneficial. If they hadn't... otherwise, because Ron brings some very important news with him, like the fact that Voldemort's name is now a taboo.
Oh, yes.
And anybody who says Voldemort is now... creates a magical disturbance, and the Death Eaters can find them immediately, and any protective spells or charms will be disabled. And Ron had gotten Harry and Hermione into the habit of just saying, you know who. And they find out that was actually how the Death Eaters found them in Tottenham Court Road way back in August.
That's
when
right.
They were running from the wedding.
And so this has been going on. And Ron had that, you know, intuition, or that feeling... You know, you probably don't remember, but we discussed this.
I do remember
last episode, and he's smart. You know, he's developed a real sense of things. You know,
yeah, he just had the strange feeling that it was sort of wrong to say. I think it's because Ron grew up in the Wizarding World where it was always wrong to say it, and now that he's back, it's like. Some terrible omen feeling again, because who knows, maybe Voldemort did that the first time around when he came to power. He put a taboo on his name.
Yeah.
And that's why the habit of using it fell out.
Ah. Using his actual name, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is... Wow, that's really good. That's entirely plausible. Yeah, because, like, why else would people be afraid to say his name? Like I could see people easily saying his name, and then once they figure out it's a taboo, and the taboo spreads, right?
Yeah.
Then people get in the habit of saying you know who, and they generally become afraid of saying his name for the fear that, you know, that the taboo's still there. Maybe I'm not sure, but you know.
Yeah, they get into the habit of not using it.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
So.
Wow.
Way to go, Ron. Bring that information back with us.
Way to go, Heather, for coming up with that. I mean. 12 years of Harry Potter.
Oh, thanks, Adam.
You're welcome. This book came out in 2007, and that never occurred
to me
once.
I think that's the first new theory I've came up with since 2008.
Good stuff.
This whole podcast has just been me recycling what I've said on forums in 2007.
Really? Oh, that's funny.
Also, another thing that's happening in the Wizarding World is gossip about Dumbledore. Rita Skeeter's book has gone big, and they're all debating how much is true, and what's a lie, and what did Rita just make up, and what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that was a very good idea of Rita Skeeter to publish that when she did, because she's backed by the Daily Prophet, and the Daily Prophet is controlled by the Death Eaters now.
Yeah.
And so it works as, like, a blow to morale for those fighting against Voldemort to have, like, their great champion Dumbledore, not just that he died, that wasn't enough, but the fact that it was revealed that he was actually a dark wizard, or, like, friends with a dark wizard, at least, and spent some of his time working for ideals that Voldemort also believed in, that would have been a massive blow to any morale
that they had. Absolutely, it would.
Because I've said this before, but Dumbledore is so often seen as, like, the big godlike figure that sort of is all-knowing, all-present, always knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And so, just the fact that he's been taken down a peg, and that maybe not everything he always did was perfect, or should be repeatable, or should be done again,
mm-hmm.
or followed, just goes to shake the base of people's beliefs against Voldemort.
Yeah.
Hermione has been reading The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore as well, though. That's also another big connection, I guess, they have to the outside world, is this bestseller that Hermione picked up. So I guess that'd be like if Adam and I went camping now and found... I don't know what book we would find, and then we'd just be poring over it, thinking, oh, this is all that's happening in the world.
Yeah, that's right.
This is all we need.
That's funny.
But in the book, Hermione finds a weird little note from a letter that Dumbledore wrote to Grindelwald. It's a copy of the original letter, so it has his signature, clearly. And instead of an A, there's a little tiny triangular shape with a line running through it and a circle in the middle, which we have seen before
on
Xenophilius's chest at Bill and Fleur's wedding.
On Xenophilius's hairy chest. At the wedding.
Right. Right, exactly. They're shaved into it.
Oh my god.
So Hermione suggests that they need to go visit Xenophilius Lovegood and ask him about a shaving cream and razor. Hermione suggests that they go and visit Xenophilius Lovegood and find out a bit more about this mark, because by now they've seen it in so many places. It's like it's following them. They've seen it at the wedding. On the gravestone of the Peverell brother, Ignotus Peverell in Godric's Hollow.
Yeah.
In the Tale of Three Brothers story.
Not yet.
In Hermione's book.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yep. And now in Albus Dumbledore's name, so...
Something's going... Like, they need to figure out what this is.
Something's fishy here.
Something is fishy, that's right.
So they decide, well, not really they decide, Hermione decides that they should go there, and Ron, wanting to be back in Hermione's good graces, automatically sides with her, and it's just like, yep, totally good idea, let's do that. And so Harry really has no choice but to go, even though he's worried it's going to wind up just like Godric's Hollow again, and it'll be a place that, you know, everybody's watching and waiting for them to go to.
Yeah, that's right.
Because Xenophilius is a big supporter of Harry. That's another thing that Ron brings up, is that the Quibbler has been sort of an alternate media presence from the Daily Prophet, because the Daily Prophet is controlled by the Ministry of Magic, which of course is controlled by Voldemort and the Death Eaters now.
That's right. Controlled by corporate interests.
Mm-hmm. Not even corporate interests, just evil interests.
Evil interests.
Just pure evil.
Evil politics.
Evil, genocidal, political, corporate, Death Eater interests.
Yes. Very good.
That's controlling the Daily Prophet. So now, this ragtag little Quibbler that has, like, previously just been known to print bizarre articles about Cornelius Fudge baking goblins into pies.
Ragtag. I like it.
Thank you. Is now this sort of bearer of truth and light into the wizarding world about what's actually going on.
I love this.
And it's funny because you can kind of track almost the change in the Quibbler from Order of the Phoenix when Harry does the exclusive interview with it.
Yeah,
like that was that was probably the first time the Quibbler ever printed the truth.
What was the Quibbler before? The Quibbler was like this flimsy little magazine that really had nothing to it.
It was like the National Enquirer.
There you go. Yeah,
I don't know if you have that in Canada.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, they sell that at Superstore, and it's ridiculous.
Wait a second.
What?
If you have the National Enquirer in Canada, is it the United States version or the Canadian version?
It's the world edition.
Oh, okay.
Whatever.
Wait,
it is.
Why is it called a National Enquirer? So?
No, it's called
it should be the International Enquirer.
Oh yeah, that's right. No, I think it's American. I remember seeing a story on there about Bat Boy or whatever. The boy was half bat and the cops were chasing after him. Yeah, so but anyways, what I was getting at was like kind of ridiculous, I know. I didn't really believe it. But yeah, so going back to the Quibbler here, so it's like the National Enquirer beforehand, but I feel like when Harry's interview happens in the fifth book, it becomes a lot more, it gets more substance, right? It becomes a lot more political, in my opinion.
It becomes subversive. It becomes subversive literature.
Yeah, there you go.
Because it's going against what the government
and political
is spewing.
Too. Yeah, that's right.
Saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of backlash. It starts to backlash against politics.
It's a backlash against the mainstream media because people are realizing that that's not always reliable.
Yeah. Whereas if you look at something like the National Enquirer, that's just like phony ridiculousness. That's not even a backlash against mainstream media. That's like
that's
a parody of the mainstream media, you know?
So imagine if suddenly the most reputable news source you had was the National Enquirer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And like it had risen to the challenge. Actually printing the only truth.
Yeah.
So the trio goes to visit Xenophilius Lovegood, and they're excited because it's Christmas break, so Luna will be home. But when they get to the door, Xenophilius Lovegood is hardly that welcoming to them, and he hesitates to let them in. And when Harry asks for his help, he's very unsure about what to do, which is odd because everything he's printed so far has just been saying, like, help Harry at any cost. Like, that's our goal, is to help Harry Potter. But here, when Harry Potter is at his front door, he kind of wants to edge them out of his house.
Yeah, and you know what? I had something I wanted to bring up about this, right? He's busy printing all of this pro-Potter, like, propaganda, almost. And, why? And, like, he knows. He knows that the wizarding world is in danger. So why doesn't he and Luna go into hiding somewhere safe where they can continue to print off this pro-Potter material?
Well, I imagine it's a lot harder to go into hiding with the printing press than with, say...
Well, magic, right? They can stick it in, they can stick it in one of those bags that Hermione has.
I guess, but that's, like, really advanced magic.
Yeah, okay, maybe.
But, I mean, at this point, like, to get a little ahead, they're being watched by Voldemort.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think they could go anywhere without the Death Eaters knowing.
Yeah, that's true.
So, their house is really weird, just on a...
just on a side note.
Just on a side note that we'll come back. It's really weird, it's all circular, and has these different levels, and it's filled with really weird stuff, including a giant horn that, Xenophilius insists is a Crumplehorn Snorkack horn, but Hermione knows is an Arumpet horn, which is very dangerous. So, wonder what that's going to be about.
Yeah, right. Foreshadowing.
Couldn't possibly come back.
Yeah.
But anyway, after going outside, you know, to supposedly call Luna, Xenophilius comes back and he's like, okay, what do you guys want to talk about? And they say, oh, well, it's the sign that you were wearing at Bill and Fleur's wedding. We've kind of been seeing it a lot. Can you tell us anything about that? And Xenophilius says, ah, so you wish to know the tale of the three brothers.
Ooh. No, he says,
or no, that's not it. says,
He says, "Ah, so you
are you referring to the sign of the Deathly Hallows?"
Oops. Yeah, it wouldn't have quite the same effect if he said that first thing, but yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I've been reading a lot of Lord of the Rings, and I think Gandalf says something similar to
that
at
right.
some point.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so that's how the chapter ends, but I just wanted to bring up one more thing in this chapter. Inside Zeno's house, he's got a statue of Rowena Ravenclaw, and
ooh,
she's wearing...
Does he?
And yeah, and she's wearing this elaborate headdress to kind of like... and it was like in replacement of her diadem. And so mm-hmm. this is the first time we learn of the diadem, which is like a tiara. And mm-hmm. this is the first time an identifiable Ravenclaw artifact has been mentioned. Ooh. So that's another thing that we need to look out for, even though we know how it will end. But yeah, just wanted to bring that up.
Chapter 21. The Tale of the Three Brothers.
Okay, so I'm going to take her away with chapter 21. This is The Tale of the Three Brothers. And so finally we're introduced to the meaning of the book's title in this chapter, The Deathly Hallows, because we learn about what the Deathly Hallows actually are. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, Xenophilius states that the sign that he has is of the Deathly Hallows. And it's not a dark symbol, like what Victor Krum stated at Bill and Fleur's wedding, like it's, you know, it's a symbol of evil. It's not that. It's simply he wears it so that he can indicate to other people who have the symbol that, you know, they believe in the Hallows and that they believe in the legend of the Hallows and that they're engaged in this quest to find them. And so that's simply mm-hmm. what it is. But I thought it was really interesting because... Krum is so set on, what does he say at Bill and Fleur's wedding about the symbol? That it's an evil symbol of some evil wizard or something like that?
Of Grindelwald.
Of Grindelwald.
It was carved into the wall of Durmstrang by him.
That's right, yeah. And I just wanted to draw parallels between, and I'm sorry we've done this already, but it's so perfect, the Deathly Hallows symbol and a swastika and Grindelwald and Hitler. You know? Like,
yep.
It's a symbol that wasn't originally an evil symbol, at least I don't think
but it has become one.
But it has become one, and to certain people, and to many, many people, they see the symbol as something of evil, and it's hard to get that negative connotation or association away from that originally decent symbol, for lack of a better term. Like, it wasn't intended to be evil in the beginning, right? And then certain mm-hmm. circumstances happened, and it was used in a certain way, and everybody now associates it with something very evil. Like, we will never look at a swastika and say, oh, that's, you know, not an evil symbol of World War II and the Nazis, right?
Yep.
Like, that's just the way it is for us.
That's so, just what it has become. That's what it is.
That's what it is, right. So I thought that was an interesting parallel. And
yeah.
So anyways, moving along, the fairy tale, Hermione pulls out the book and she starts to read it. And
ooh, are you going to read it to us, Adam?
I am not going to read it. I will summarize. Man. I will summarize. Three brothers, Antioch, Cadmus, and Ignotus, the Peverell brothers, make a bridge over a river to cross the river, and they are confronted by Death, who is a hooded, cloaked figure on the bridge. And he says, because you have managed to defy or slip past Death, I'm going to grant you... or I'll give you each a gift, or three wishes, or something like that. I don't quite remember exactly. But anyways, the first brother, he asks for a wand to defeat other wizards. And so Death fashions him a wand, which is the Elder Wand. The second brother, who is a very arrogant brother, he wants a little stone that can bring people back from the dead. And so Death gives him the little stone. And then the third brother, who is very humble, he would like a cloak of invisibility to further shield him from Death. And so Death gave him a piece of his own cloak. And this cloak, we now know, is with Harry. So anyways.
Wow, thanks, Death.
Yes, thank you, Death.
It's like Christmas over here.
That's right. So anyways, the first brother who is very boastful.
Wait. Did the three brothers have to sit on Death's lap?
Yeah, right.
First, and then ask what they wanted?
Yeah, and whisper in his ear what they wanted. Yeah, they had to do that. So anyways, the first brother is very boastful, and he's defeating people with his new wand that is unbeatable. And in the middle of the night, one of his enemies comes in and takes the wand from him and slits the brother's throat, and that's how death takes him. The second brother calls back his loved one, his wife or his fiance or something like that, who got very ill and died, but soon realizes that she's very unhappy in the living world because she's dead and she's not supposed to be there. So in desperate longing for his loved one, he kills himself so as to truly join her. And then the third brother, after he lived a long and plentiful life, sheds his cloak and gives it to his son, and then departs the life or the world of the living with death as equals. And so these are the three Deathly Hallows, and the Peverell brothers, as Zeno says, are the three that are believed to have originally owned the Deathly Hallows. So I find this crazy. Right now in the room with Harry, Ron, and Hermione and Zeno, there are two Deathly Hallows.
There are.
One is in the snitch and one is in Harry's bag.
And imagine if Xenophilius knew, like if,
I know.
I don't know. 2 years later, somebody tells him.
I know.
He would have just been so annoyed because he had worked his entire life.
Well, and they're talking about it. That's right. And they're talking about the cloak. And Zeno says that this cloak, you know, it never wears out. It will always, the person will always remain concealed forever, mm-hmm. you know. And Harry, Ron, and Hermione look at each other like, we have a cloak exactly like that. Because I think with a normal invisibility cloak, after
it
a while,
out after
the
a
charm
while.
Wears out. That's right. And it doesn't mm-hmm. work. But none of them really thought, about how good this cloak is, right?
Because as far as we know, the cloak is at least, 20, 30 years at this point.
That's right.
Because it was Harry's father's, and it still works just as well as it ever did.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I find it also interesting, Harry's father gave it to Harry, right? Mm-hmm. Through Dumbledore, but still, it was passed down to Harry from the father, just as Ignotus passed it down to his son.
Yeah, that could imply that the family had been passing it down, father to son, since Ignotus.
That's right. I'm sensing a direct familial connection here, right? So mm-hmm. Harry is a direct living descendant of Ignotus Peverell, which I think is pretty cool.
So, and Voldemort, we find out later, is a direct descendant of the second brother.
Really? When do we find that out?
Because in my next chapter, they realize it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. We'll talk about that then.
Save it then.
I forgot about that. So, after a while, after they learn about the Deathly Hallows, Zeno then goes to make dinner, and he says that Luna is out at the stream fishing for plimpies? Is it?
Yep.
Freshwater plimpies for the soup. And I find this just kind of funny. Harry, a pungent smell wafts into the sitting room, and Harry thinks it smells like burnt underpants. What do burnt underpants smell like exactly?
Harry, why are you so familiar with that smell?
Yeah, right. I'm kind of worried. So Harry goes for a little walk before he goes for a walk, the trio is kind of deliberating amongst themselves the possibility of the Hallows and, you know, whether they could be real or if they're just a legend. I find this really interesting because they talk about the Elder Wand, and Hermione brings up the idea or the fact that all of these powerful wands have surfaced through wizarding history, right? And they've all been taken by somebody or stolen from somebody or given to somebody, and they're all called different things like the Death Stick and
the Wand of Destiny.
The Wand of Destiny, that's right, yeah. And so they all kind of deliberate the possibility that all of these wands might in fact be the exact same wand, just mm-hmm. going through different times in history, which I think is really, really cool. And very mysterious and almost eerie in a sense. For me,
I suppose there's sort of a Muggle equivalent with us of powerful swords that have never been beaten, like Excalibur.
Well, okay,
sort of, and like,
but is that a
thing? I'm not.
I mean, you're more.
Well, I imagine that there are other swords like said to be as powerful as that. Like,
you're more.
I don't really know if Excalibur is unbeatable. Actually, come to think of it, but
it's a powerful.
But, this idea of super powerful weapons and tools. That have surface throughout time.
Yeah. But I also have another question here. Why is the Resurrection Stone dismissed as least likely to exist? Especially when Hermione, like, especially when ghosts are a thing, right? Like, they know ghosts are real.
Yeah.
But they dismiss the Resurrection Stone, which doesn't really make any sense to me.
Well, when you become not Saint Nicholas, nearly headless Nick in Order of the Phoenix, he tells Harry that once somebody dies, they have a clear choice to become a ghost or not.
Yeah.
And I think that is sort of the ghost's last act as a human, like the last use of their magic, to choose that life or not, to choose that afterlife or not, to be a ghost or to move on. And I think that that's not really external magic, so to say, of becoming a ghost. That's internal, but whereas the Resurrection Stone would be a magical act that somebody else did to somebody to bring them back.
Okay, yeah.
And so I don't think no spells work on the dead like that.
Yeah.
And okay.
Yeah, so if you choose to, like, if you choose to remain a ghost, then yes, you're a ghost, and people know you're there, and you still have contact with your loved ones and everything.
Yeah.
But if you choose to go into the afterlife, I guess, or be not, you know, die, in a sense.
Yeah.
Then there's no way you can come back. And so the Resurrection Stone is unlikely because it is supposed to bring people back from this afterlife, which typically nobody can return from.
Yeah, because I feel like this is a theme that's come back a lot in Harry Potter, especially in this book.
Yes.
It's the theme of death and not being able to cross over between the two. And, like, once somebody is dead, they are dead, and that's final. Like, they cannot be brought back, no matter how much you may wish, and that you have to keep on going. Like, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. You have to move on past that.
Yeah, okay. That makes total sense then. Cool. So, anyways, one other topic that I wanted to bring up here, which is very, very significant and relevant, is the whole concept of mastering death. And so we learn in this chapter that if the wizard is able to collect all of the Deathly Hallows, all three of them, then he or she will become the master of death. And I just wanted to talk about the ambiguity of this phrase, because, like, depending on what person you are in the series, or, you know, the different people in the series, they all have different ideas or notions about what it actually means to master death, right? So Voldemort, you know, being able to kill others in that sense is mastering death for him. And also with the Resurrection Stone, being able to call others back from the dead is also mastering death, right? But, but, you know, I think what the series, or, you know, what is projected through the series as the main way to master death is really, like, the one true way to master death is to continue loving and believing in those who have died, right? And that's kind of the resounding theme of the entire series, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought it was very interesting because in that sense, the symbol, you know, the little triangular symbol of the Deathly Hallows, or even the Hallows themselves, are like the physical representation of what this entire series is about. And
definitely.
I think, and so that puts the title of the book and, you know, its significance in this book into a whole new perspective for me, and how, like, it's very, very appropriate, you know, to be called, the last book is called The Deathly Hallows, because the Deathly Hallows symbolize the entire Harry Potter series. So that
and also it's an end.
What do you mean by
not fearing it? Well, I think, you know, it's the end of Harry Potter. It's kind of the death of Harry Potter, at least the books. And I think that also another idea of mastering death is no longer fearing it.
Fearing
it. Like, we've seen that since Nicholas Flamel.
Yeah.
Chose to get rid of the Sorcerer's Stone. And Dumbledore says, you know, his classic line, "To the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure." And we see that the true master of death, I think, in the Deathly Hallows tale is the third brother.
Yeah.
Because he goes to death without fear, and he goes as an equal. Like, he's no longer at the whims of death, and because he knows that he's lived his life, like, properly. He was able to do that because he didn't fear death.
Yeah.
He was able to live his life fully without fearing death. And also, the main villain of the story is Voldemort. who his fear is death. His fear is death. Like, if he saw Boggart, he would see himself dead, I imagine.
Yes.
Whereas, in the people who die in the book on, like, on Harry's side, it's not so bad because they didn't fear death because they knew that they were leaving behind a better world, like, with Remus and Tonks. That's why they went and fought and died, because they knew that they would be leaving behind a better world for their son.
Yeah, that's awesome.
They didn't fear it anymore.
That's awesome. And that kind of makes me think about, you know, death in the real world, right? Like, you know, my own death and my loved one's death. And it makes me think, you know, if I, you know, over, like, I'm afraid at this point in my life, I'm so young, right? I've got all of this life ahead of me. I'm not going to lie. I am afraid to die right now.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it's not my time yet, right? I feel like it's not my time. And I feel like when the time comes, if I'm not afraid to die, then I will have mastered death. So, like,
exactly. Then you will know that you mastered death and life because you did your life well.
Yeah. And so this book or this message from the book really has some resounding qualities or you know, things to it that readers can take from and apply to, you know, their own lives, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is really powerful. So anyways, to end off the chapter here, Harry goes to Luna's room and sees a bunch of paintings of him and Hermione and Ron and Neville and Ginny up on the wall. And you know, he feels a big surge of affection for Luna because these are her friends, right? And she spent all this time painting them up on her wall. But then he notices something odd, that the room is all dusty. And apparently Luna's supposed to be at the house because that's what Xenophilia said. But, you know, the fact that there's an inch of dust on everything kind of proves that she hasn't been there for a while. So he goes back downstairs and Zeno comes in with his soup. And Harry says, "So where's Luna?" You know, and they confront him about it. And Zeno drops the tray with all the soup and everything, goes crashing to the ground, and there's a few spells that are thrown, I believe. And I think the snorkack, or the horn, or whatever.
Snorkack?
The horn explodes, or something like that.
Hermione blows it.
Hermione blows it, yeah, that's right. And and Zeno reveals to them that Luna's been taken by the Death Eaters and that, you know, they were angry with him about what he'd been, all the Pro Potter stuff he'd been writing, right? And if they, and he says he can't let them leave because if he turns Harry in, then he gets his Luna back. And in one respect, I feel angry towards him for doing this or, you know, upset. But on the other hand, I can totally understand why he's doing this. Because Zeno's a good person, right? He's a good guy. I can understand why he's saying this to them or why he wants to do this. And even in the book, when Zeno kind of blocks their way, it even says Harry is kind of, it kind of reflects in Harry's mind his own mom doing that for him when he's a baby.
Yeah.
Right?
Because on the one hand, it's Xenophilius's job as a father to protect Luna and keep her from harm, and he's would be doing that by handing in Harry to the Death Eaters. But on the other hand, that is just the complete opposite of what Luna would have wanted, like, because she's been fighting with Harry for 2 years now, and she would have, I think that she would have just been so disappointed with her father if she found out that he had betrayed her friends.
Yes, I completely agree with that. Yeah, she would be completely pro-Harry on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, she would. And, you know, I, even though she's imprisoned at Malfoy Manor at this point, I, you know, knowing Luna, you know, knowing her character, I feel like she's making the best of it somehow.
Definitely.
You know, like she can stay there. She can survive. She's a survivor, right? She's not.
I feel like Luna, like, this may sound kind of cheesy, but I feel like Luna sort of has a deluminator within herself. Like, she can just bring light to places.
Yes. Well, yeah.
Just with her personality and her presence. Just.
That's right.
Cheers everything up.
Yep, and I bet her and Ollivander are having a right fun old time there down in the dungeons, down in the cellar. So, but, yeah, so that's what Zeno says. And then the Death Eaters arrive, and they kind of burst through the downstairs, because everybody's kind of upstairs. And the Death Eaters arrive, and they're angry because they don't believe that Zeno has actually found Harry. And they said, you know, if you're trying to trick us, then, you know, we're going to do something about this. And of course the stairs are all blocked. So they're trying to make their way through the stairs and Zeno's yelling at them. No, I actually have Harry here. I have him here. And then Hermione does something very, very clever. Like, it's
classic one of the, Hermione.
Classic Hermione. Like, she thinks, like, she's very narrow-minded. I know, like, Zeno even says, you know, she's very knowledgeable, but she's very narrow-minded and kind of, you know, sees only the black and white and things, the logical side. But, you know, this is something that Hermione can do incredibly well. She thinks logically and she acts on a moment's notice, like perfectly, like without any flaws. And so what she does is she takes Ron and she throws the invisibility cloak over him and she tells him to put his hand on her shoulder. Then she takes Harry and she first, like in the matter of like 30 seconds, she obliviates Zeno's mind so he forgets everything that they talked about. And then she blows a hole through the floor so that they fall. And this is so that the Death Eaters can get a glimpse of Harry so that they know that Zeno was not lying and they don't harm him or hurt him further, right? And then they apparate, and that's basically the end of the chapter.
So, that is absolutely brilliant.
It is brilliant. Like I
never would have thought of even writing that.
I know, me too. Exactly. Like, that's what I was thinking as I read this. I was like, how does Jo even come up with these things, right? How does she come up with these tiny little things and even other things in the plot and, like, entwine them together?
She's smarter than all of the characters.
I wonder what her IQ is. Like, really, I wonder what Jo's IQ is. I'd like to know.
So high.
It must be. It must be.
Like, 268 or something.
Exactly that, yep. But, yeah, it's a really, like, Hermione did a very good thing. And, like, she thought of Ron as well. She threw the cloak over Ron so that Ron,
so this family is safe.
That's right, yeah. She saved, basically, like, three different families from peril by doing what she did in, you know, 20 seconds. So, yeah, that's basically the end of my chapter. And let's move on to chapter 22.
Chapter 22. The Deathly Hallows.
Okay, so chapter 22 is The Deathly Hallows. Wonder what that's about.
Yeah,
I wonder. So they land in the middle of this field, well, a corner of a field, actually. And that matters, I just looked at it. It's a corner. And they're all still just on this huge adrenaline high from just barely managing to escape. And they pretty much, Hermione fills in Ron and Harry on everything that she did, as Adam has just filled us in.
Yes.
And they're absolutely blown away by it still. And they're, you know, all conflicted about what to feel about Xenophilius, like we are. And then they get around to discussing the Deathly Hallows, and Harry's all excited because he thinks they're real, but Hermione is just dead set against it because it goes against what Hermione is. Like, it goes against her
logical mindset.
Her logical reasoning that, you know, things in fairy tales don't come true. Like, they're not going to find some magic beans and, like, throw them on the ground and then go visit an ogre, like...
Yeah, that's right.
Like, to her, it's a fairy tale, and, like, it's a nice story, but it's not gonna be true. Like, maybe the wand is, because there have been tales of very powerful wands, and that's, like, documented throughout history, but none of these other things are documented except for in this fairy tale.
Yeah, I agree.
Which, I actually, wrote a paper on fairy tales. I did some studying on them last year. And there's actually quite a lot you can learn from fairy tales, because there are certain things that symbolize just aspects of community and history. So you can clearly see, like, what communities were suffering from, bad harvest at what time, and which communities had war happening to them, and which communities had, like a plague. And you could clearly see that.
Yeah.
Like, fairy tales do say something. A lot about the culture that they come from. And the fears of that culture and things like that. But Hermione doesn't focus on this. She just looks at them as a whole and says, okay, well, they don't exist. Like, clearly they're in a fairy tale, so it's just a fairy tale.
Yeah, so black and white, you know?
Yeah, which is unfortunate because she has such a brilliant mind.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I imagine, like, just combining, like, Hermione and Luna would get, like, a superhuman intelligent being.
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally.
So she spends some time trying to convince Harry that the Deathly Hallows don't exist, and that's not what they should be focusing on. They should be looking for the Horcruxes. But to Harry, it's all very clear, and that it all makes sense, and that Voldemort's looking for the Elder Wand, and, you know, he has the Resurrection Stone, because he remembered the name Peverell from the memory in the Pensieve when he went to go visit the Gaunt's house with Bob Ogden and Albus Dumbledore, and he remembered the man brandishing a ring with some strange etchings on it, and saying, this is, like, the seal of the Peverell family, like, yeah. I'm descended from it, and so he just figures, oh, well, then the ring, he goes to some very impressive, like, conclusions he jumps to, is that the ring must be in the snitch, and it's funny because all of these things that he's saying that seem sort of far-fetched and, like, seem to fit together a bit too much...
are true.
are true. And, like, Harry's not used to that, because this is, like, this and Half-Blood Prince, I'm pretty sure...
He's a
genius.
...are
the only times when Harry gets things right.
That's right. I agree with that. Because normally he's completely wrong and there's a big twist,
yeah.
right? But in this one, he's completely right. It's just everybody else thinks he's wrong.
Everybody else thinks he's wrong. He's yeah. like... oh, well, this cloak that I have, it must be, you know, Peverell Brothers, because my parents didn't have it when they died. Dumbledore had it, and Dumbledore wanted the Deathly Hallows, so he must have been examining it, and Dumbledore and my family are from Godric's Hollow, and that's where the Peverell Brothers were from, and he's just jumping all over the place. And it's honestly, like, it's astounding to read, like, to me. It gets my heart pumping, because I'm like, oh my god, what are they going to find out next? Like, every time I read this chapter.
Yeah, it's true. That's
like,
true.
I'm, like, expecting some different conclusion.
That's funny.
But it's always the same.
Yeah. It's always written the same way.
yeah. It always ends with Ron being sensible, actually.
Yeah.
And while Harry is, like, deep in the, like, deep in the depths of his mind, trying to come up with more theories about the Hollows, Ron is like, hey guys, let's go look here, let's go look here, come on, Horcruxes, yeah, like, it's sort of his turn now to, like, keep everybody going, while, like, Harry and Hermione are, like, battling each other's wits about the Hollows. Ron is like, okay, come on guys, we still got Horcruxes to go, come on.
Yeah.
Which is such a change from how he was back when he was still wearing the Horcrux around his neck and just being such a miserable man and, like, not wanting to go anywhere. Now he's the motivator. He's, like...
he's the go-getter.
The leader. Yeah, he's the go-getter type that's, like, bringing everybody out.
Yep. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
And Ron also... he finally manages to tune into a radio station that he had been trying to get to.
Can I just stop you there for a sec? I just wanted to quickly
sure.
say something. Sorry about that. But just going back to the Hallows, I just wanted to say that, you know, the Deathly Hallows, you know, Harry thinks about the Hallows and he's coming to all these conclusions. And the Hallows capture Harry's attention because they offer a way out of his impasse or his situation.
They do.
Right? So, like... mm-hmm. This power, right, if he were to go and find the Hallows, this power would be sufficient to defeat Voldemort, and mm-hmm. he'd have a way to speak to his parents again, and
yeah.
he'd no longer have to grieve. So, like, I'm not surprised that he sees this fairy tale and really considers the possibility of these things being real, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because looking at Hallows or Horcruxes, right, the Hallows offer so much more of an easier way out, in my opinion.
Definitely.
To defeating Voldemort than tracking down these Horcruxes, this brutal task of, grueling task of finding these Horcruxes. You know, he thinks he knows where the Hallows are, he should go and find them and get them, and then he would be mm-hmm. master of death, and all, he thinks at this point in time, you know, all of these benefits will happen, but on the other hand, you know, searching for the Hallows instead of the Horcruxes, he would be also abandoning his faith in Dumbledore and essentially
yeah.
giving up any possibility that Dumbledore knew what was best for Harry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of choosing himself over Dumbledore, in a sense,
yeah.
you know, or
because,
betraying Dumbledore's trust.
Yeah, as the book goes on, we see more and more disillusionment with Dumbledore, with Harry wanting to veer off of the path with the Horcruxes.
That's right.
And go find the Hollows, because he's like, okay, well, maybe Dumbledore isn't the man that
he thought he was, right?
Yeah, like,
yeah.
he's not a god. Like, we don't have to follow every yeah. exact little thing that he said.
He questions
then,
whether Dumbledore even knew what he was doing, right?
Yeah, and earlier in Xenophilius Lovegood, at one point Ron is like, you know, I wonder if sometimes I just think that Dumbledore was having a lot, was just like having fun and like sending all these weird clues that led to nothing just to make fun of us and annoy us and just for the heck of it.
Yeah, I agree.
Which I thought that about Dumbledore sometimes too. Like, what are you doing? Just like, it's so complicated, Dumbledore. So complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I also mention that this whole chapter is omitted from the movie?
Yeah, that's too bad, because this is one of my my favorite parts in this is when they're listening to the Potter Watch radio show.
Yeah, that's true.
Just one of my favorite parts in the book, because I think it's so nice that Lee Jordan, after his experience as like a Quidditch commentator, like he would come back to be the radio host. That makes so much sense.
Yeah, it would.
When you think about it.
I agree with that.
Like, it's incredible. I'm so glad that they had him, like, play a role in the fight against Voldemort, too, because he was such good friends with Fred and George, and he was always in Dumbledore's army. I think that's really nice that
yeah,
he came back.
Yeah, I agree. And also, what was I going to say? Also, Potter Watch itself is kind of Harry's reassurance that everybody's okay. You know?
It's true.
It's kind of his connection, because he's lost all connection with everybody, right? For months and months, and this is kind
of... it's sort of like, even the name, it's sort of just like seeing the messages people left on the plaque at Godric's Hollow, just like a physical presence that somebody out there still believes in him and like has in the past week, like they still support him.
Yeah, I agree with that. But anyways, carry on.
And it's nice to hear familiar voices like Lee Jordan... And also Kingsley and Remus and Fred Weasley himself.
Yeah.
And they all, it's just this really nice moment for Harry, Ron, and Hermione to hear these familiar voices bringing, like, a little humor, even, into their dark tent.
Yeah. You know, they need, it's like their little, you know, Saturday Night Live.
Exactly.
Of their week, you know?
Right. Remember when we tried to do a Saturday Night Live opening?
Yes, it worked out very well. Tried, we did. It was awesome.
Excuse me.
It was great. I thoroughly enjoyed editing that episode. It was awesome. But I wanted to bring up something with Potter Watch, actually. Once again, we're kind of tuned into alternative media here, right? And this, in a sense, more so than the Quibbler. Because radio...
Definitely, because the Quibbler was still like an established...
Yeah, and this is a...
Printing, like, as an established magazine, but this never existed before in any way.
Yeah, and it's
they're running between safe houses and, like, probably, like, jamming the radio frequencies, like, because,
yeah.
Like, you can't... Not anyone can just, like, get a radio frequency. You have to jam it.
Yeah, that's right.
And, like take over a frequency that somebody else has, sort of.
Yeah, and so they've done that, and they're doing this secret radio broadcast, and,
And like, I'm sure their studio has been raided and they've had to, like, be on the run.
Oh, yeah, I'm positive.
And everything like that.
But it just shows, you know, like, the strength that they have and how they're you know, it's bringing solidarity to all the listeners and encouraging them to rise up against Voldemort. Very much so, like, alternative media in the Muggle world tries to, you know, that's what their purpose is, right? To take back media democracy among the people and report, you know, true news and unbiased news that's not in interests of corporate media. But anyways, also
just the sense that so many other people are listening to the broadcast at the same time you are.
Yeah.
There was somebody else out there
that's listening,
who shared your ideas
and hearing it. Exactly. And, but I was really interested because I wanted to know, cause you know, Joe has modeled this whole, takeover by the Voldemort and the Death Eaters on World War II and the Nazis and everything. And I wanted to know if there was some kind of alternative media during World War II. And so I did.
Yes, there was, Adam. Funny you should say.
Yeah. You know, right?
Yes, there was. The Allies, at one point, they set up, radio towers, after they had, made a little dent in Europe, I guess, gained some territory back in France.
Yeah.
I suppose they set up radio towers. Or wait, no, this may have been the Cold War, actually.
Well, In any case.
But anyway,
some kind of war.
Somewhere in Europe, there was, yeah, I think it was the Cold War, but anyway, they set up a radio tower that would, broadcast, like, American news bulletins into, occupied territories by either the Germans or the Soviets.
Wow. Yeah, there you go.
Probably this. I think it's the Cold War. So
probably the Cold War. But I do know that during World War II, England would set up something called secret broadcasts, and they would. These were, you know, radio broadcasts that were hijacked, just like Potter Watch, right, is doing, and they would be broadcasting this alternative media, and this media would be loaded with these little clues that, you know, spies and you know, people who were against the Nazis, you know, workers or whatever, government workers or secret agents could take the clues and decipher them and use them as, like, directions or instructions on what to do, right? And this was, this was, like, done during these broadcasts from the BBC, which I thought was really, really interesting. So, yes, this kind of stuff did actually happen.
And also, people have been doing this for ages, but, like, well, not ages, since they had planes, like, in every war, like, one side has rained down leaflets that said, like, surrender in, the other side's language, and sometimes the translations weren't so great, so sometimes they would say, like, surrender for better sweets or something, like, instead of saying, like, surrender for sugar rations.
Yeah, for better sweets.
Yeah.
That's funny. But yeah, so that's a little interesting historical parallel.
Yeah, subversive media has been everywhere.
Yeah.
Forever, and it's nice to see it in the Wizarding World.
Yeah, absolutely.
Though we do find out some unfortunate things, like Ted Tonks, Dirk Cresswell, Bathilda Bagshot, Gornuk, a goblin, and many families of Muggles have been murdered since the last airing of the episode.
Oh, Ted Tonks. That really made me
Ted
sad.
Ted Tonks, which, you know, Harry knew him, and he was traveling. These were the people that they heard across the river.
Yeah, that's right.
On the Extendable Ears, and so their friends, you know, Dean Thomas was with them, so now, naturally, they're all worried about him. But another, just a little good news is dropped in there from Remus Lupin, saying that Harry's instincts are almost always right.
Yeah.
Which implies that he is back with Tonks, living together again.
Yes, good.
And she's, they're just happily pregnant now.
Good, good.
So that's a little bright spot.
This is kind of like the calm before the storm, almost.
It definitely is. Of this.
Yeah. Because the next chapter, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. And that happens because Fred mentions that there have been reports that Voldemort has been seen abroad, which gets Harry very excited because that fits in with his theory that he is looking for the Elder Wand, and so Harry, in his excitement, forgets about the taboo and says Voldemort's name, and the Death Eaters come for them.
Chapter 23 Malfoy Manor.
Oh, gosh. And I remember this part was so tense. I needed to read the next chapter. I had to. So the Death Eaters have come for them. Their enchantments are off because they said the name, right? And you were talking about a magical disturbance. So the Death Eaters drag the trio out of their little tent there. And, Hermione, she puts a spell on Harry's face. That's right. And
always she, know what to do, Hermione.
She does. She puts this, what was it, a stunning spell? Or
A stinging hex.
Stinging hex on Harry's face so that it swells up and his scar is barely visible so that the Death Eaters wouldn't know who he was, right? And I mean, it's a bit of a stretch to do that because I feel like they could still easily know who he is or figure it out, right? But still, it was better than nothing on Hermione's part. And it worked.
Yeah. Luckily, they're dumb.
That's right. Luckily, they're stupid. So, anyways, the trio is dragged out. Chapter 23, Malfoy Manor, is, it's not a lot plot-wise, but there's a lot of action to it, so there's not going to be a whole lot to talk about. But I will bring up some things here. So first of all, the Death Eaters take the trio the trio has to quickly think of some names so that their identity remains hidden, right? So Ron says that he's Stan Shunpike. Duh, stupid.
Which he already used.
Which
he used that when he met the Snatchers as he was on his way from Harry and Hermione's camp when he left.
Yeah, but it's yeah, okay, yeah. It's obvious,
though,
that...
Stop being Stan Shunpike, Ron.
Yeah, well, they know that, obviously, this isn't true, right? And so then Ron says, you know, changes it, saying, all right, I'm a distant relative of the Weasleys and blah, 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 right? And then Hermione says, Penelope Clearwater, and it's always so weird when I see the word Clearwater written in these books.
Oh, yeah.
That's the town I am from in BC.
But Penelope Clearwater is a Muggle-born anyway, isn't she?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, so why that wouldn't make any... No, she must not be, though. She must
maybe
not.
She was half-blood.
Yeah, because she's not in danger by calling herself Penelope Clearwater, right?
Yeah.
Actually, there's... I'm just going to click on her name right now. Penelope Clearwater. Okay. No, it doesn't say anything about what her blood status is.
Okay.
So, she must be safe. And then Harry says he's Vernon Dudley, which is hilarious. So the Snatchers recognize Hermione's photo from the Prophet, and so they know that she's lying about her identity. They find Harry's glasses, but they're still unsure of who he is. So they decide to take him to Malfoy Manor. Oh, yes, and one of the Snatchers also finds the Sword of Gryffindor, which is going to play a big part here. So they bring the trio to Malfoy Manor, and this is the kind of conclusion or climax of Deathly Hallows Part 1. And inside Malfoy Manor, Draco is summoned. We see Lucius and Narcissa, and they call Draco over to identify Harry, because if they call Voldemort over and it's not Harry, everybody is in big trouble, right? So Draco takes a look at him, and Draco knows! He knows that it's Harry. Like, if Ron and Hermione are there, and it's obviously Harry, right? I've always found this so far-fetched. Even Lucius and Narcissa should know that that's Harry, because Ron and Hermione are there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's still got the same body type and the same hair, right? It's just his face that's been all puffed out. You know, and they found Harry's glasses, so why would they even hesitate about this?
Yeah, like, who wears those glasses besides Harry?
Exactly. Those
honestly,
round
Draco.
Glasses. Yeah, exactly. But Draco says he doesn't know, and we find out later that Draco, you know, was lying, right? Because Draco has got, you know, a bit of good in him, right? Mm-hmm. He's not the horrible villain that his family is and all the Death Eaters, which is great. And then Bellatrix walks in, and she's insane as ever. Holy, this character is
Hooray.
Just insane. What happened in her life to make her the way she is? Like, really? Mm-hmm. I would love to know that story, and I really hope that Joe writes something for Pottermore once I finally get back on that thing. I really want to read something about Bellatrix and see why she is the way she is, because I think that would be fascinating. But so she comes in and she sees the sword that the Snatcher has and says, "Where did you get that?" And he says, "I found it and I reckon it's mine." And immediately, right? And they keep calling her woman. Woman, what's wrong with you? And immediately Bellatrix shoots these stunning spells at them and all hell breaks loose. Like no build up to it, anger or, you know, arising. It's just instant, you know, give me that freaking sword, right? Yeah. Holy crap. And so she sees the sword, she gets the sword, and she's angry because she feels that her vault has been breached. And
and that was like the one thing that Voldemort trusted with her with.
That's right, that's right.
Like you had one job, Bellatrix, and...
if we want to bring internet memes, you had one job.
You had one job, Bellatrix. Because this was after they had already, like, lost all their credibility.
That's right.
Her family, and, like, this was, like, the one thing.
This is
like,
the one...
last chance she had to prove that they were, like, loyal and good.
This is, like,
well,
the...
not good, but, you know.
This is, like, the one strand of loyalty that's connecting this family to the Death Eaters and keeping them safe, to be honest. As ironic as that is, right? So, and even Bellatrix says to Narcissa, "You don't understand what this means, Narcissa, so just be quiet, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm making a big deal out of this for a reason."
Right, because Narcissa doesn't know that,
she doesn't
know that there's a Horcrux hidden in.
That's right.
Bellatrix's vault. Yeah. She probably just knew about the sword.
That's right. That's right. So, I thought that was pretty funny. Harry, Ron, Dean, and Griphook, the little goblin, are taken to the cellar where they meet up with Luna and Ollivander. And it's great to see Ollivander again. Just saying. I think it's awesome that we see him in person instead of in these dreams that Harry has. And I forgot to mention that Harry has this vision of Voldemort, and Voldemort is talking to an ancient person who I'm assuming is Grindelwald.
Yeah.
And Grindelwald.
In the tower.
In the tower, that's right. And Grindelwald says that he was expecting Voldemort and tells him that he never had it, which Harry assumes is the Elder Wand, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, this happens.
No, wait. Where was Dean in the basement, or did the Snatchers have him as well?
No, Dean was taken to the basement.
Okay.
The Snatchers had him when the trio was caught, right? Dean and Griphook.
Okay, I thought so.
Sorry, we didn't mention this, but Dean and Griphook were there as well, and all of them were taken to Malfoy Manor. So yeah, Dean and Griphook.
Oh, nice, a reunion.
That's right. It's a reunion. Yeah, even for Griphook, because Harry saw Griphook in the first book.
Yeah, they know each other.
They know each other. They're good pals. Going back to Bellatrix, she says that Snape sent this sword to her vault in Gringotts, right? She says Snape sent it there, but we all know that Snape replaced the sword before he sent it to Gringotts, mm-hmm. right? So he actually has the real one.
Yeah.
So Hermione stays up with Bellatrix, and Hermione gets tortured. She gets crucioed. And I remember reading this. I'm going to reminisce here and say that this terrified me when I read it. Like, this legitimately sent shivers down my spine because we have never... Like, this torture has never happened to the trio before, ever. Like, it's happened to Harry, but, I mean, it's Harry, right? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Hermione has never been subject to cruelty of this degree. And so it really, really got
I was
to me.
Absolutely horrified because somebody told me that Hermione died in this book.
Oh, God.
So I spent the entire book on the edge of my seat waiting for Hermione to die.
To die.
And I really, really, really thought she was going to.
No.
In this scene.
I would argue that she almost dies here.
Yeah, that she definitely almost dies.
But she doesn't exactly die. And Ron is just having a heyday. Hermione, he's yelling Hermione's name. And she's almost.
I wouldn't exactly call that a heyday.
Okay, never mind. No, no. He's having a bad time. what is the definition of a heyday? I kind of just used that.
Like
word.
A good old time, because, you know, like a heyday is when you all go out and haying, and then you get the hay from the, like, you hay the fields, and then you have a celebration with all your friends and family afterwards.
He's not.
It's a thing, Adam.
He's not having a heyday, then. He's having a bad day.
Because you had a bad day.
That's right. And the soundtrack is playing as he's screaming.
Yeah, Daniel Powder plays in the distance.
Oh, God, way to kill a movie. They send Draco down to the cellar to grab Griphook because Hermione, while she's being tortured, is yelling, is sobbing and telling Bellatrix that the sword they have is a fake and you know, it's the real one is somewhere else and it's still in her vault, right? The one that they have is a fake, and Bellatrix doesn't believe it. So she gets Draco to get Griphook from the cellar so that he can go up and declare that it is a fake. And before he goes up, Harry specifically says to him, make sure you tell her that this is a fake. So they do that. And then after this happens, Dobby appears. And it's great to see Dobby again. Oh, yeah. And the reason he appears... So much stuff happens in this chapter.
I know.
It's like one thing after the other. Harry looks in the little mirror shard he has, and he sees a blue eye. And it looks like Dumbledore's. And so he out of desperation, pleads for help. Mm-hmm. And then the eye disappears. Then Dobby appears in the cellar, right? And he takes Luna and Dean and Mr. Ollivander to Shell Cottage, because that's where Ron tells them to go. And then the cracking sound causes Wormtail to come down and investigate. And this is a scene that is not in the movie, and I really don't understand why they decided to take this out of the movie, because it could have still been in there. Like, it would have done no harm to the movie if it had been in there. I mean,
yeah.
It wouldn't have been too gruesome. I mean, they've already tortured Hermione, for God's sake, and it's been terrifying. So, I don't know. But anyways, Peter Pettigrew comes downstairs. And he sees Harry there, or he sees that nobody is down there except Harry and Ron, and he goes at Harry. He jumps at Harry, and his silver hand grabs Harry around the neck, and while Harry's being choked, Harry says to Wormtail, you know, you owe me a life debt because I saved your life in book three. I'm assuming that's what he means, right? When Lupin and Sirius were about to kill him, Harry saved his life, and this causes Wormtail.
Oh, I'm so glad that came back, because that's like just been something that's been bothering me for like four books.
What do you mean? How so?
Like, because I knew that like Peter Pettigrew like owed his being free and everything to Harry, just having mercy for him.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, and I knew that both Remus and Pettigrew would die because, you know, all the other marauders and people from that era had died, and so I knew that Pettigrew was going to, and so
I just
knew that that was going to happen, and I was glad to see it in this way, I suppose.
Well, I remember
like Pettigrew, like his hand betraying him.
Yeah, that's right. And I
just as he betrayed, you know, his Harry's parents.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I remember reading in book three when Harry, you know, saves him from death, right? And I remember being so frustrated because I was like, just kill him, right? He's obviously a bad guy. And I love the irony of how this act of saving Pettigrew's life turns around and kills him in the end, you know?
Yeah, and also if Harry had allowed Sirius and Remus to save them, to kill Pettigrew then there wouldn't have been, like, any way for Harry and Ron and Dean and all of them to get out of the cellar.
That's right, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So
like, acts of mercy help the people who perform them.
That's right.
Is the moral.
That's right. And so anyways, Harry says this to Pettigrew and his hand kind of slackens because he's having a moment of doubt. And because he has this split moment of doubt, the hand turns on Pettigrew and he strangles himself to death, which was obviously Voldemort's intent, right? Because I think Voldemort knew that Pettigrew would kind of lose his loyalty towards Voldemort.
Yeah, because that's what Pettigrew does. He goes from, like, to whoever he sees as the more powerful of the situation.
That's right. He's a total pushover.
Definitely. So that's a
such
good
a
foresight of Voldemort's to have,
That's right.
Like, to have the hands that he gave to Pettigrew kill him if he ever went away, like, straight from his orders.
That's right. And it sends a message to all you pushovers out there. Mm-hmm. You know, get a life, make your own choices. You know, or else stuff, you know, S-H-I-T will go down. I didn't say it, so you guys can't email me and tell me that I am bad. Yeah, can I have some mints? But, yeah, so Pettigrew in his pushoverness kills himself.
Yep.
Which I still think would have been a great scene for the movie, but they decided to take the comical approach.
Let it go, Adam. Let it go.
It's going to come up next week when we watch the movie. I swear to God. But anyways, Harry and Ron rush upstairs. Harry's got Wormtail's wand now because his wand was taken. And Griphook has now told Bellatrix that the sword is fake. And Bellatrix is very satisfied that her vault is, because she feels her vault is safe. And she then summons Voldemort and offers, and this is so cruel, she offers Hermione to Greyback as a reward. Holy crap. And anyways, Harry's scar explodes with pain, and he sees Voldemort in his head, and he feels what Voldemort feels. And Voldemort is very angry at being summoned at this point in time as he's talking to Grindelwald, right? Because what worse time to summon Voldemort when he's like, talking to a very important person about
something busy.
That he needs. He's busy, right? He's got a lot of things to do, right?
Yeah.
He's got a busy schedule. So in his anger, he kills Grindelwald just because, you know, he just felt like killing somebody at that point in time.
Yeah.
And Ron comes in. We're kind of back in Malfoy Manor. Ron comes in and disarms Bellatrix with Wormtail's wand while Harry catches Bellatrix's wand and stuns Lucius Malfoy with it. And then Bellatrix has this silver knife, and she points it up to Hermione's neck and she orders them all to drop their wands or else she's going to, you know, slit Hermione's throat. And Draco collects all the wands. And then all of a sudden, crack, Dobby appears. And, like, this whole thing, like, there's so much going on right now. Like,
yeah,
it's, like, one thing after the other. Dobby appears. He drops the chandelier on Bellatrix. Narcissa.
So many things.
So many things. Narcissa.
Like, I love how the perspective of this chapter kind of jumps back and forth between what Voldemort's thinking and where Harry is, because I think it really shows how deep the connection that the two of them have.
Yes,
that
I agree.
They can almost be in two places at one time, which is actually what something similar to what Harry said back, like somebody told to Harry back in Order of the Phoenix when he was worried that he had bitten Arthur Weasley, was that, Harry, how could you possibly be in two places at one time?
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
Well, in this way, he sort of is.
Yeah, that's right.
At least
right.
Mentally, he is.
Mentally, he is. Yeah, I would argue that, yeah, mentally, he is. And, you know, because so much is happening, I feel like this is, they did such a good job at splitting these two movies, right? And this mm-hmm. final scene is perfect for the climax of a movie, you know?
Yeah.
Especially part one, like, it's intense, it's evil, it's fast-paced. You know, yeah. People are, you know, getting hurt. So, Narcissa is disarmed. Ron pulls Hermione out from under the chandelier. Sorry, it's just kind of funny.
I imagine it's just like a terrible trip to IKEA.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, on their terrible trip to IKEA, the chandelier falls down and Ron has to pull Hermione out. Harry takes this advantage to go to Draco and grab all three wands from Draco, and then he stuns Fenrir Greyback, and then finally all of them are together, and Bellatrix addresses Dobby as an enslaved house elf, and this sets Dobby off completely. He declares that he is free, he's a free elf.
He has found his liberation.
He's found his liberation. He's...
And even if this is, you know, one of his last moments, I'm very glad that he had this chance to tell off all the people that abused him.
That's right, yeah.
For all of those years.
Stroke of genius on Joe's part there. Harry tosses a wand to Ron and tells him to go, and then Harry, Griphook, and Dobby disapparate to safety, but as they're disapparating, Bellatrix throws a knife, and the knife goes in with them and hits Dobby in the chest.
No, maybe it would have ended differently this time.
Yeah, I know. And they arrive on the beach in front of Shell Cottage, and Dobby whispers, "Harry Potter!" And Harry kind of gathers him up in his arms there, and Dobby dies.
No.
And did you cry when you read this?
Hell yeah.
Did you really?
I can say that, right?
You can say that, yeah.
Okay, yes, I cried a lot.
I didn't, actually.
No?
No, but, I mean, it was sad, obviously. But, you know, I read the book, and it was... I never cry the first time I read these books,
yeah.
You know? Like, because I'm so into, like, getting through the book and figuring out what happens that I just don't have time for the emotion to overcome
no
it.
Time for tears.
No time for tears. Too preoccupied. But, yeah, Dobby, he passes away. And it's very sad. And that's the end of the chapter with Dobby's death, basically. And I think they make the grave and everything in the next chapter.
Yeah.
Which, appropriately, is the beginning of the next movie. So, mm-hmm.
Which is, like, the saddest opening.
It is!
Of a movie Seriously. Ever.
Yes, it is. Very upsetting, you know? Way to... But, I mean, like... I guess it's appropriate because...
To set the mood. Like,
it sets
like,
the mood.
This is what's happened. This is what we're fighting for.
Yeah, that's right. Know? And the whole thing with Snape at the beginning of the movie kind of sets the mood as well. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the end of the chapter. I guess next week we're going to go over... we're going to watch movie one, I guess, eh?
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Movie seven.
Movie seven, part one.
I guess. Yeah.
And Sarah's going to join
Which
us.
I haven't seen in a while, so I'm looking forward to
it. I haven't either. I've had urges to see it, but I've mm-hmm. deliberately put it off because I know we're going to be watching it
yeah.
together as a group. So
yep.
That's going to be fun. Movie commentaries are always fun because yep. it gives you a chance. For those of you who are new to the podcast, you're a little late, first of all. Just saying. But it, you know, movie commentaries are fun because you can sit in front of your TV and you can put in the headphones and you can play the movie along with us, and we discuss mm-hmm. all of the little things on how they made it and our thoughts and takes on different
and
scenes.
And it's very relaxed. It's very casual.
It's, you know, real chill.
make jokes and make fun of each other.
Yeah, make fun of the actors.
Yeah, it's a really good time, I think. Yeah. I'm biased, but...
No, we all are. That's part of the fun of it, right? Yeah. There's no prep because we kind of... Well, I mean, there's prep in that we look up facts beforehand to discuss, but, you know...
Yeah, and, like, we've read the books beforehand.
Yeah, that's
up
right.
Up to that point.
Up so to that point.
We're fresh on them.
Yeah, we're pretty knowledgeable about what happens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah... anyways, that's about it for the episode. I'm going to go over some contact information. First of all, you can visit our website. It's potterpensive.com. And here you can download all previous 50 episodes. 60! 60
Whoa,
episodes.
That's a lot of episodes.
That is a lot of episodes. All 4 years worth of episodes. And you can download them and listen to them and journey with us through the entire Harry Potter series. Also, you can contact, if you have any feedback, so any questions, comments, suggestions, queries, or theories, you can email us at potterpensive@gmail.com, or if you'd like to be lazy, you can just go to the Contact Us page on the website and fill out the little form there. And we really look forward to hearing your feedback, whether it be, through email or through other social media outlets, such as the Facebook group, which we really encourage
you. Make sure you join that.
Make sure you join that. That's where all of the active listeners of the podcast come together and they discuss Potter-related things and podcast-related things. It's also a good way to talk with us, the podcasters. So join that and leave us your feedback. Also, you can follow us at Potter Pensive on Twitter. And I guess that's about it. Oh, yeah. Subscribe and rate to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating, a 5-star rating. And give
it
us.
It could be any rating.
It could be any
I
rating.
Suppose.
Leave us a rating and let us know what you think of us, and preferably nice comments. That would be good. So until next week with our Deathly Hallows Part 1 film commentary. Without further ado,
Nitwit,
Blubber,
Oddment,
Tweak. See you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye.